Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a China conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. China, as in the People's Republic of China, with 1.4 billion people representing 17.4% of the world's population. It's considered one of the cradles of civilization, bringing the world incredible culture and many world heritage sites. While so many of us love Chinese food, we don't like Chinese fentanyl or fentanyl precursors or fentanyl analogs. We enjoy the low prices of so many made-in-China goods, but do you really want to buy your made-in-China insulin, baby food, or other medications? China says fentanyl is an American problem. Their citizens don't use fentanyl. I spoke to a Chinese delegation visiting the United States, and they admitted to problems with methamphetamine, but not fentanyl. They blamed fentanyl on our American culture. However, the Department of Homeland Security states that the fentanyl crisis begins and ends in China. A congressional panel has accused China of subsidizing fentanyl production and fueling our fentanyl crisis. Chinese drug companies and employees have been sued over fentanyl distribution in the United States, and China has agreed to make changes to their policies to curb what they see as our humanitarian crisis. President Trump got China to stop sending over fentanyl, but then they just switched over to sending fentanyl precursors. President Biden got China to stop producing the two main precursors to fentanyl, but then they just changed to one of 16 other fentanyl precursors alternatives and continue to supply the Mexican cartels with American-bound fentanyl. To learn more about China and fentanyl, I reached out to Ben Westhoff. Ben Westhoff is an award-winning investigative reporter whose books are used as an educational tool worldwide. Fentanyl Incorporated, How Rogue Chemists Created the Deadliest Wave of Opioid Epidemic, was his first bombshell book. He has written for our nation's leading newspapers, advised government officials, and interviewed as an expert commentator on various news media outlets. He can now add High Truths to his long list of appearances. To learn more about Ben Westhoff, check out the High Truths show notes. Ben Westhoff, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Love.
I'm really excited. I was really looking forward to meeting you, and a shout out and thank you to Jim Rao with Families Against Fentanyl who connected us. You're an investigative reporter and author. I really learned a lot and enjoyed your book. It was like a history lesson of my own, you know, profession. What drives your passion in writing these books and doing these investigations?
Well, as a journalist, I'm interested in telling stories that haven't been told. And, you know, I had a friend from fentanyl back in 2010, and I had never heard the word before. And he had fentanyl patches, which is the way people were abusing it early on. But and then when China started making illicit fentanyl, no one really had written about that or investigated it. And so that's kind of been my motivation with this story.
Interesting. Back in the days, we would see patients like that. We call them, they're wearing a fentanyl vest because they had all these patches all over the place. And we knew.
Yeah, you can still buy them on the black market, and they are still heavily abused, certainly.
And the other thing is, just because we're talking about the patches, I had a patient one time who was trying to get less, and somehow he got a patch from his psychiatrist. He cut it. And what people don't realize is that when you cut it, you actually release more fentanyl. So he overdosed and ended up on a ventilator because he tried to cut his patch. All right. So that's interesting. You mentioned in the book that it all started with your own experience at an electronic music festival when in your youth, and that kind of also sparked things.
Yeah, I mean, I used to be on the rave scene in Northern California back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and people took a lot of drugs back then, but no one ever overdosed and died. I mean, not people I was with anyway. And so fast forward to around 2013, 2014, when fentanyl was starting to break out, and all these people were dying at raves all of a sudden. And the cause of death was always listed as ecstasy. And so, but that seems strange to me because, like I said, people were taking plenty of ecstasy when I was on the scene. And so that's when I started investigating and learning that these pills people were taking usually had no pure MDMA at all, you know, the drug that's normally in ecstasy. Instead, it was adulterated with all these new research chemicals, they're known, you know, novel psychoactive chemicals, MPS. And they were almost all made in China. And the most dangerous and potent of all of them was fentanyl.
Wow. So the book, Fentanyl Incorporated, again, amazing history. It's not just a story about fentanyl. It's really a drug history. And you mentioned things like throughout my career as an emergency physician, like the fifth vital sign. And I remember when spice was a thing. It's still there, but not as much. Droperidol, designer drugs, the whole thing. So I really, really enjoyed it. Quite detailed. I'm very impressed. How long did it take you to investigate all that and write the book?
It was probably about 3 years. I mean, you know, there was kind of a learning curve because, you know, I'd heard of, you would call them designer drugs for a long time. And I always heard this term. And so I always assumed there was some chemist, you know, some nefarious chemist in a lab, like experimenting and designing this perfect drug to kill the most people. But that's really not how it works at all. All of these new drugs are basically just like subtle tweaks on old drugs. And so they're, you know, you take the chemical structure of known drugs like mescaline, for example, you know, different psychedelics. And I talked about the original kind of mad scientist named Sasha Shulgin, who experimented with the scaffolding structure, it's called, of these drugs. So he had mescaline, but he changed a few of the groups and he subtly tweaked the molecule and then he tested it on himself and you know, lived to tell the tale. And he invented over 100 new drugs this way. And so the same thing was happening with fentanyl and all its different analogs. So over the years, all these different scientists and, you know, legitimate medical labs working for universities have tried to find different drugs, create new drugs that they could patent and make money off of in the medical realm. But some of these, you know, scientists tried to tweak the fentanyl molecule and they weren't able to patent these drugs, but their research was out there. You know, their published papers were out there. And so then in the age of the internet, all of these old papers went off of just sitting on some scientists' shelves to being on the internet. And so these kind of rogue chemists had access to all this academic research over the years, and they started picking out scientists they knew specialized in drugs of abuse, drugs that could be used recreationally. And so then all of a sudden, you know, 10 years ago or so, these chemicals started coming online. You know, we say new, but really sometimes they were decades old. They had just never been used recreationally. And so then you have this whole group of people called psychonauts. These are like people who try new drugs for the first time. That's the
psychonauts, like a
psychonauts, yeah, like an astronaut, except you go on a journey in your psyche. So all these people are going on the internet, finding out about these brand new drugs that have never been tested on human beings, and they're taking them themselves. So I was very fascinated by this whole crazy world.
It's funny because when you say that, that's happening now legally. I remember back, I think it was 2010, that I was asked to give a lecture about designer drugs, and I had to like look it up and figure out what that meant is also. Again, it's like, you know, the same molecule, but they make tweaks. That's happening now with marijuana, not as a plant, but taking that a structure, what they call, but it's synthetic hemp, and they take these delta 8s and delta 9s, and they've never been tested, not even in rats, and yet they're sold legally in smoke shops.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very controversial, the hemp bill and things like delta 8. And what I would say, so delta 9 is what most people know as marijuana. That's the most common type of cannabis. Delta 8 is an analog, and it's slightly different. And what I would say about that is, like, delta 8 is just as harmless as cannabis. You know, no one is going to overdose on that or have problems.
No, there have been deaths from delta 8. There've been a baby who died.
Well, but I was going to say, but the problem is stuff it's often not regulated by the FDA, and stuff that's sold as delta 8 is actually the synthetic cannabinoids. And like you were talking about spice and K2, it's along that variety. It's not marijuana, it's not cannabis at all. It's a synthetic variation, and that stuff can be lethal for sure.
Yeah. I had a podcast with Josh Sweeter, who has a lab, and he tests marijuana products for different industries. And so we gave him some of these products that are being sold, and he found like bath salts in them.
Oh yeah, for sure. That, like I said, it's not regulated by the FDA. It's a total wild west out there. You know, if you're interested in marijuana, just get the buds, something you can smell. If it looks real, if it smells real, it'll be real. All these like vape products, you don't know what's in that vape juice. I would just stay away from that.
Yeah. So that investigation, you went to China, you went undercover, very, that's like an adventure. Did somebody fund this project, or is it just a passion? And is that how you
had a book contract. So, you know, my funding came out of that, but yeah, it was extraordinarily kind of reckless and crazy thing to do, to go to China. And I went inside a drug lab in Shanghai where they were making fentanyl analogs that were legal at the time, and synthetic cannabinoids too. And I pretended to be a drug buyer, and the chemist, the owner of the lab, he pointed out, this is a fentanyl analog, this is the spice, the K2, the synthetic cannabinoids. And they were sending out bags of these raw chemicals all over the world. And and I also went to Wuhan. This was pre-coronavirus, so I had no idea what to expect in Wuhan. And there I went to a chemical company, a huge company. They had like 700 employees, and they were selling fentanyl precursors. And so those are the most important chemical ingredients needed to make fentanyl. I've heard it described as like the brownie mix. You know, it's not the final brownies, but if you have the precursors, you have what you need to make fentanyl. And so these were just young people sitting.
I like that analogy. I haven't heard that before, the brownie mix.
Yeah, it's not mine. I think I got it from an AP story, but all these salespeople were sitting at desktop computers and selling fentanyl precursors just like it was any other chemical. And the scope of this operation was really staggering.
Ben, I think they could make a movie about your adventure going into there. And when I was reading your book, I was thinking, this guy is a journalist. How is he masquerading as a chemist, like somebody who knows this chemistry language? Like, I feel like I'd like, you know, and I was a chemistry major, that I'd mess up in the language of
I messed up a lot of stuff. I mean, they said at one point, he was like, so you want some of this fentanyl product, how much? And I said something like 10 kilos, you know, just kind of talking out of my rear end. And he was like, you know, that would take us like 8 months of continuous work to make that. And they were like, that's not a realistic amount. You know, people order this stuff by the like the gram, you know what I mean? And so I yeah, there was a lot of hairy parts.
And then what was your chemistry background? Because you had to know a lot about these different precursors. And it seemed like you knew a lot about that.
I studied chemistry in high school and then in college a little bit. I'm no expert. I mean, my biggest challenge with the book was actually like dumbing it down, you know, because people get really like intimidated by these long chemical names.
Yeah. But I don't know, you're probably the only book or even articles who gave so much detail about the chemicals. I think that was important because nobody else has done that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's important because when you read in the news about all these new drugs, these news anchors, and they have no idea what they're talking about. They're like, this new drug, it's worse than fentanyl. You know, this new drug, it's a zombie drug. You know, they have all these euphemistic names.
Right. Or even in like recent current events, like, oh, China's going to fix this problem. Like, really, they're going to like stop one precursor, or there are 16 others.
Yeah, it's very complicated. And like to understand, you know, like there are good drugs and bad drugs and drugs that are in between. And really, it's the dose, you know, even fentanyl itself is an important hospital drug, of course, as you know. But they have trained anesthesiologists who know how to measure it in these tiny, tiny quantities. Whereas on the streets, you know, it's possible to take a safe amount of fentanyl, but dealers on the streets have no idea what they're doing. You know, I talked to a guy who uses a Mr. Coffee grinder to grind up his fentanyl mixed together with his heroin. And that's not going to work. And plus, the dealers don't even know what they have. Like, they're getting it further up the food chain. It might already be adulterated. It might be stepped on two or three times. They don't even know. So it's a total mess.
Yeah, I know. It is a little ironic that people sometimes have trouble trusting the medical profession. And yet, like, oh, but my drug dealer, they know. They know better. Yeah. So you're... Again, harrowing story of you going into China. How you had to, you went undercover, you had to lie. Was that like scary? Like I would not have a good poker face.
No, it was scary. You have to keep your lies straight. That's the hardest thing. You know, and obviously I don't look like what my idea of a drug dealer would be, but the good thing is like, they wanted to believe me, you know, they have a financial incentive to believe me. And they do get, you know, like Westerners coming there all the time to buy these chemicals and sell them. And so I kind of had that sort of on my side.
Wow. And so you went, did you go several times? You said Shanghai and
Hawaii. No, I only made one trip to China because, you know, the State Department told me I could not go back because I might be on a list of some sort. I was doing journalism without a journalism visa, and that can get you thrown behind bars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, there goes your future. I hope you got to see the Great Wall.
I did, yeah, it was awesome. I loved being there. It was a great trip otherwise.
Yeah, wow, that is pretty scary. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about China. China claims that fentanyl is a United States problem. It's not their problem. They maybe have fentanyl. Their citizens don't use fentanyl. What's going on with that? I mean, and I think it's true. Their citizens don't use fentanyl. They probably get in trouble if they did.
Yeah, well, certainly the United States and Canada are the only major countries that have a fentanyl problem, and it's directly sprung out of the overdose, overprescription of OxyContin and Purdue Pharma and all that story we've heard. So, you know, China is right. We do have a demand problem, but China is the supplier, and nowadays it's the precursors that are sold to the Mexican cartels who push it north of the border. So like you said, China doesn't have a fentanyl problem, but their citizens do have problems with other drugs like heroin and meth, for example. And China makes a very concerted, strong effort to crack down on drug abuse in its own country. And you can get the death penalty really for possessing only fairly small amounts of these drugs. And so, but it is ironic that they don't crack down on fentanyl in that same way. And it's, you know, you've got to think that the reason is because its own citizens aren't affected. You know, a lot of people ask me if they think it's some sort of conspiracy to win a type of a non-traditional form of warfare to try to poison the U.S. And I haven't found any, you know, it's kind of smoking gun evidence about that. But I think it's a more simple answer than that. It's really just about money. And China has been trying to grow its chemical industry and its pharmaceutical industry. And so it actually gives all these tax breaks for export of chemicals, including fentanyl and all sorts of stuff. And this, the national leaders, I don't think, want China to be known as the drug pusher to the world. But local leaders, if they have companies in their provinces that are employing a lot of people, paying a lot of taxes, even if it's with these, you know, unethical drugs, they have a strong incentive to look the other way.
Yeah, it is interesting because for the conspiracy theory, Wuhan gave us COVID and fentanyl, and it just it hurt America, both those things, and the world.
Yeah, well, Wuhan is known as kind of for its major universities and strictly its chemical industry. And so it's kind of a pipeline from one of these, you know, top students to these chemical companies. And of course, the vast majority of them work for legitimate companies, but there's also some, you know, there's a lot of work in this sort of gray area, you would call it, making chemicals that are legal in China, but illegal in the US. And it's very easy for, in this competitive environment, for these chemists and lab owners to justify it. They say, well, it's legal in China. And so, you know, in China's defense, they have generally done what we ask, you know, like we asked them to ban all these fentanyl analogs, and they did in 2019. And we asked them to ban some fentanyl precursors, and they just recently banned more. But the problem is that, like you said, there's so many different chemicals that can be used to make fentanyl. And eventually you get down to precursors. So these are often chemicals that can't be banned at all because you need them for legitimate products, you know, cleaning.
But you don't need them in that quantity, right? There could be a way around it, right? As far as
well, I don't know if the quantity is necessarily the factor, but more what the US wants China to focus on right now is vetting the buyers for these precursors. So, you know, it's very easy to tell if this is like a Mexican cartel front who's trying to buy these chemicals from you, and as opposed to a legitimate pharmaceutical company or whoever. And so if China would require these companies to do their due diligence, to have a list of their sellers, then that would help a lot.
Just to finish the conspiracy theory, this is not payback time for the opium wars, where China was the victim of the West selling them opium. And now, you know, a few hundred years later, it's the other way around.
Yeah, a lot of people have noted that similarity, and it certainly is ironic. You know, it's definitely something to think about, you know.
Yeah. So explain to us the Chinese regulation loopholes, where it's illegal in the United States, but it's legal in China or the United Nations. How does that work? Another type of whack-a-mole.
Whack-a-mole, yeah. For one thing, the United States has what's known as the Analog Act. And so that means that anytime a chemical is scheduled or banned, automatically anything with a similar action or a similar structure is automatically banned, right? So when the U.S. banned fentanyl, scheduled fentanyl, for example, all analogs of fentanyl, everything similar to fentanyl was automatically scheduled as well. China and most countries don't have a law like that. And so in China, they have to generally have to schedule all these chemicals one by one by one by one by one. And so this is a long process. I mean, there's literally infinite types of fentanyl that you could make, right? And so traditionally what happens is a drug will become popularized like on the internet or something. And no, you know, it will just have a smaller group of people who are buying it, and then it gets to be more and more popular. And then finally, the government finds out about it. Only at that point, the government might initiate the process to ban something, to ban this new chemical, but that takes a long time too. And so it's during this sort of like bureaucratic window that these chemists, like the ones that I visited, that I went undercover in China, that's when they tend to make their most money.
Wow. So now the lab, tell us more about the labs in China, and you also call them shadow labs. What's the difference between a regular lab that's making fentanyl or a shadow lab?
Well, a lot of these chemical companies do make legitimate products. Also, I went to one company in Wuhan. It was called Yuan Chung, and they claim to make 10,000 different chemicals, and they specialize in this synthetic form of cinnamon. But they made like Cialis, and they probably are making Ozempic, and you know, the sort of generic forms of that. And so that may all be true, but then sometimes, you know, at night they might be making some of this more gray market stuff. I mean, the crazy thing about Chinese chemical, drug traffickers is that most of these are law-abiding companies who want to follow the law. And so the moment that China bans this certain chemical, they actually will just throw the rest of their stock away. You know, they fear the government. And so it's just a very different environment than we're used to here in the West.
Wow. And, you know, Congressional House Committee accused China of subsidizing or incentivizing fentanyl production. How does that work with the government? How is the government indirectly funding and incentivizing fentanyl sales?
That was the finding from my book, actually. I was glad and I was featured in that report. There's a number of different ways. One is what I mentioned, the tax rebates. It's called the value-added tax rebates. For exports of fentanyl and other chemicals, you get a tax rebate on the money you spent for the raw ingredients, for example. They also have sort of grants that companies have gotten, like this company, Yuan Chung in Wuhan. They received some grants, $50,000 here, you know, different sizes for developing different products. They're considered biochemistry is considered in China to be a high tech industry. So these chemical companies are part of that industry. And so since China is looking to build up its biotechnology, its high tech industry, a lot of these companies get subsidized land in these like office parks dedicated to, you know, tech. Ostensibly, they get to take advantage of that, and even funding for like A&R and things like that. And so, you know, these are incentives that are intended for legitimate chemicals, but it spills over in the country, and the companies making these gray market chemicals take advantage of it as well.
So is it coming from legitimate companies, and then at night they like turn on their side business, their fentanyl precursor business?
Well, sort of, except that that definitely happens. And there are plenty of labs making completely illegal chemicals in China too. That's just like any other country.
But are those illegal companies getting the tax breaks and the land and the car and the vacations?
No, they're not getting these government subsidies. It's just companies that are following the letter of the law and making these chemicals that are, like I said, the gray market, meaning still legal in China, but banned in the US.
And so when you said shadow company, shadow factories. Is that what you meant? Not the completely illegal ones, but the ones that are
have a.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's my term. I may have quoted someone who said that. I think there are definitely like people making illegal stuff on the same equipment at night. You know, I've heard actually more about like knockoff purses. Like there might be a company, a plant that makes like a Fendi bag or a Coach bag or whatever. And then for legitimately like for the real company, but then at night there's like people who make the knockoff bags using the same equipment. And I think that's sort of the idea.
Interesting. So, I mean, that's kind of a sobering thought when you're saying that there is Chinese-made Ozempic, baby food, insulin. Like, we know that a lot of times when we buy stuff on Amazon, it's made in China. And a lot of times it says made in China, but I don't think most people want their medications made in China.
Yeah, with stuff like Ozempic, it's a big issue. And the problem is that Ozempic is really expensive, and a lot of name-brand pharmaceuticals are. And so there are plenty of people who try to buy the generic version of that drug online. And they're getting it from these Chinese chemical companies. And often there can be all sorts of adulterants in it, very dangerous stuff. And I've actually been working with a company called Transparency that's focused on developing testing kits for these online meds people buy to find out if they're real.
You know, it reminds me of, did you see the movie? I don't know if it was on Netflix, but it was about a cosmetics made in China that look exactly like brand expensive cosmetics, and people would buy them because they're, you know, they're cheaper, and then they'll put on the lipstick and then their lips are glued together because it has glue and it's not like the pure product. It seems to me like the same kind of thing. Like you could make a little movie about that, and instead of like cosmetics, it's medications.
Yeah, this is like a much bigger market too than something like fentanyl. You know, these are people, law-abiding people who are just trying to save money by doing this, and the market is huge. So it's a real issue.
So what about the people who are selling these precursors? Like you mentioned in your book, who is the largest seller of fentanyl precursors? There's an individual.
Well, at the time, yeah, it was this company in Wuhan that I investigated called Yuan Cheng, and the CEO is named Ye Xuan Fa. And I met him, I interviewed him twice, once when I was undercover, and then again when I admitted I was a journalist and did it properly with the translator. And he was indicted after my book came out by the US Department of Justice with a $5 million reward offered for information leading to his capture. But you know, he hasn't broken any laws in China, so he's a free man there, and he probably will not be arrested unless he is dumb enough to fly to the US or something, where people could, on vacation or something, where he could be arrested getting off the plane.
So is he still at it?
Yeah, their company still operates. Yeah, a German journalist actually visited, kind of retraced my steps just recently. I wrote about it on my Substack newsletter, which is called Drugs Plus Hip Hop. And he found the company was still operating, but it was just a kind of a shell of itself. There were like I said, there was like 700 employees at its peak, but now it's just a tiny fraction of that.
So, James Rowell, both our friends, his son, Tom, died, sadly from fentanyl, and it was traced straight to China from his cell phone. He's suing for wrongful death Fujing Cheng Zhang. I'm probably saying the name, mispronouncing it. But did you run across him? He's apparently running free in China as well.
I think so. I would have to look. I believe I'm familiar with that name. But yeah, that's another way besides buying it on the street, which comes through the Mexican cartels, but buying off the dark web directly from China. And, you know, that's very common. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot that we can do. I mean, there's been an effort by the U.S. Department of Treasury to financially punish these actors. And I think, you know, there's been some headway with that. But you know, another really big issue, in fact, financially, a much bigger issue than fentanyl itself, is money laundering. And the Chinese actors have like stepped into this game in a big way. The Mexican cartels are making billions upon billions of profits in cash. And so they need someone to launder this money. And so these Chinese facilitators have started to do that. And I think that's sort of the next front in the fight against fentanyl, is to try to stop these money launderers, because without them, there's the whole system will kind of grind to a halt.
Can you give us an example of how that money passes on from, and does it happen in our country under our nose?
Yeah, well, it's often, so there's like, if there's a fentanyl sale in the US, it'll be an American giving cash to maybe a Mexican American or someone cartel affiliated. And then sometimes this cash is laundered through like, I've heard of like Southern California sweatshops or clothing stores, or like small stores in Mexico itself. There's a million different ways to do it. But basically what happens is that there's these, like, I guess you could call them shadow transactions. So at the same time, the cash is given from one, from maybe the Mexican entity to the Chinese entity. And then the digital transfer is made in the other direction simultaneously, but with the fee shaved off, for example. So there's nothing that's technically connecting these two transactions. So that's what makes it hard to trace.
Is this all Bitcoin?
I think there is, there Bitcoin is one way it's done, but I think it's also can be done with traditional banks, and also real estate is also very common, especially in Canada. There's a huge sort of Chinese Canadian population in places like Vancouver, who I've actually heard this is like directly affected the real estate market, led to serious inflation in the Vancouver real estate market, because so many homes have been purchased with this drug money. And there's a lot of Chinese nationals, people living in China, who are trying to evade their country's cap on the amount of money you can send out of the country per year. I forget what the exact amount is, but if they can park this money in real estate instead, that makes another way to wash this money.
Wow, I think that happens here too.
Sure it does.
Yeah, the Chinese marijuana grows, bringing the conversation back to marijuana, is that connected with laundering, or is that just a different scheme?
Well, you know, the Mexican cartel is used to dominate in marijuana sales too, to the United States. It would be grown in Mexico and sold here. But since it's become legalized in so many states, that's tapered off, although it's not disappeared. You know, there's marijuana that's illegally grown here in the United States. There's ostensible, you know, there's a lot of diversion from like legal states to illegal states. And so there's certainly money laundering tied up in all of this too, but I don't know how it works.
Yeah. So when Chinese now's on, you know, the news saying that they're making efforts to curb the cell or precursors of fentanyl that's coming to the United States, is that real? Is that a pre-election spin? Or is it whack-a-mole? We're going to get rid of this precursor. We're just going to use a different one.
Well, it's definitely whack-a-mole. And even if China were to like do exactly what we wanted tomorrow, the industry would just move to somewhere like India or another country that has a big sort of not very well regulated chemical industry. So, I mean, I don't think we have much hope for trying to slow fentanyl deaths using these techniques. But, you know, is China doing something? Like I said, they really have responded to what we've asked them to do, not at the speed we would like, certainly. And so, you know, I give China some credit for putting in a real effort. But like, will it actually do anything? I mean, I'm completely skeptical about that. And just generally skeptical about this idea that this is the way to stop the problem. So the problem is that Americans are dying at record numbers from fentanyl and other drugs. And the idea that we're going to stop these drugs from getting across our borders is just ridiculous. You know, like, we could never stop 50 pounds of heroin from getting in from Mexico to the US, for example. And 50 pounds of heroin is the same as 1 pound of fentanyl. So there, you know, people get drugs into a maximum security prison. You hear about prisoners dying of drugs all the time.
Right.
So it's just you know, we waste like tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars every year trying to stop drugs from getting into this country. And it's just the biggest waste of money imaginable. And what I believe is that if we want to stop people from dying, we need better educational programs. We need to like educate kids that any powder, any pill could have fentanyl in it. And we need to work on medication-assisted treatment programs for addicted users, because the vast majority of the people who are dying are addicted opioid users. And we have great medications, you know, naltrexone, methadone, buprenorphine are the three FDA recommended medications, but they're barely used at all. And that's where we need to put our focus.
Well, I would challenge that. And I think the focus needs to go even more upstream than that. Because if you're saying that, you know, China is sending fentanyl to America and Canada because we have more of a demand for drugs and the rest of the world doesn't, then we need to work on demand reduction, which is education. But really, drug addiction is a pediatric disease. It starts when you're young. So we need to teach life skills, resiliency skills of how to manage life when it's hard without going to drugs.
Yeah, I just completely agree with you on that.
Yeah. And if you look at, because you kind of said at the beginning that the whole fentanyl crisis was born out of our opioid, opioid crisis, the prescription one, the one that me and my colleagues were part of with Big Pharma. We stopped that. And at the time, we had two patient populations. One that were addicted, you know, they would come to me with a bucket of medications. And I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to do with this? I need to just keep you alive somehow. That was like harm reduction in those days of like, how do I manage your medications? I can't take them away from you, but I need to keep you alive. Versus let's prevent the new generation of Americans being addicted to pain medications in the first place. And we fixed that with that front end solution. So I kind of feel like that's the strategy we need here for our demand reduction. Yet we have this huge drug culture where it's okay and normalizing drug use. So we're in a predicament.
Yeah, well, the question of harm reduction is definitely something a lot of people are talking about and have different viewpoints on. And
well, I think the different viewpoints is because harm reduction is important for a subset of the population, right? It's not meant for kids who don't use drugs. It's meant for the very people, my patient population that comes to the emergency department. They are homeless. They are severely addicted. They have, you know, they're maybe not really ready to get treatment. So we need to just keep them alive somehow. And there's a role for that in that population, but to expand it to the as a universal thing, that's I think where it becomes a problem.
Yeah, well, harm reduction means different things to different people, and I would put even education in, you know, that bucket. But certainly, like for in Switzerland, you know, it's a very much smaller population, much less diverse, but they do things like they give heroin to long-term addicted users. This is government-supplied heroin, and you have to have been addicted for more than 2 years or something, and you have to use it in the facility, et cetera. And so they've had good results because it kind of puts the drug dealers out of business. The addicted users are getting, you know, a clean, non-adulterated supply, and you can live to a ripe old age on opioids.
Why would you do that if you have Suboxone?
Well, it's not, you know, it's not the same for an addicted user. And they, you know, I mean, people who like heroin, I'm not an expert on like a difference between those two. And I don't know that, there's a study comparing them, but in terms of the Switzerland group, it's just, it had the effect of putting the drug dealers out of business largely, which meant that they couldn't market to the next generation coming up. And so I'm not saying like the U.S. is ready for that, but there's so many different ways to think about it. And, you know, the places like Vancouver, San Francisco have really extensive harm reduction programs, but they're not seeing very good results. So it's very much still an open question.
Yeah, I think the things are really different here. I mean, we could look at, again, marijuana, where we have a legal market that has not had a dent in the illegal market.
Well, places like California, yeah, is famously kind of the legalization has not had the effect of shutting down the illegal sales at all. It's like the majority are still illegal sales in California. I don't know if that's exactly right, but illegal sales still are huge in California. Other states have had better luck. I mean, we've had some sort of ancillary negative effects of the legalization of marijuana. There's a lot more deaths, people driving while high, for example, you know, more sort of kids with, you know, it affects, you
it's, know. It's a risk factor for psychosis. I don't think the majority of the public realizes that, right? So, I mean, I guess that's why I like talking about marijuana, because it's still kind of like what you said at the beginning. As an investigative reporter, you like to go and explore things where people haven't been. And I feel like this is a, you know, if you're using heroin or fentanyl or meth, you kind of know that that's not so good. If you're smoking a cigarette, you know that that's not healthy and you're making an informed choice of doing that. But yet the whole, you know, America says marijuana is good, it's healthy, it's a medicine, and you don't know that it's, you know, that if you're between the ages of 9 and 12 and you use marijuana, you're at 11-fold risk of developing psychosis. Or that if you have a heart condition, that's probably not the right drug for you.
I wrote a story on this, like, marijuana is not health food, you know, and we shouldn't treat it as such. You know, at the same time, like, If marijuana displaced alcohol as like the primary like way people relaxed on the weekends, would that have net positive public health consequences? Maybe. I mean,
I don't think so, because, you know, depending on the amount of alcohol, that's also unhealthy, and we have, you know, rules for that, and we have really good worldwide regulation for alcohol. If you're buying a beer or a wine, you're not worried about having methyl alcohol and going blind, right?
Yeah, well, I'm assuming that, you know, there is sort of a
regulation. That's the problem. We've been promised, and the public believes that if they go to a nice fancy pot shop that looks like the Apple store, that they're getting, you know.
But I mean, like alcohol has been completely normalized in our country, and there's like, if you don't drink, you know, you get all sorts of pressure from everyone. It's like, it's so incredibly ingrained in our culture. And it's so destructive. You know, people, this, we've been talking about the opioid crisis for so many years, but alcohol has killed just as many people, if not more.
Yeah, that's true. And at least there are like dietary guidelines for alcohol, you know, saying, you know, like if you are drink more than 3 as a woman, 4 as a man, you know, then you're an at-risk drinker. So we've quantified that. But with marijuana, again, you don't know the quality. You don't know the people, like, again, we're on this health craze, but they insecticides, pesticides, contaminants.
Yeah, that's a lot of pesticides in marijuana, for sure. You know, we're in the really early stages. At some point, there will have to be some sort of national guidelines when it's, right, you know, when it's federally regulated. But right now, it can be pretty crazy out there.
Your experiences, you know, we started, like, you know, that you as a youth in Northern California and in the rave scene, and now you've really studied this. How's your attitude changed? And I don't know do you have kids, or, you know, or if you did, what would you want them to know?
Yeah, I have young kids, and they are getting towards the sort of problem age. And, you know, just got to be really real and honest with them that, as I said before, any pill, any powder can and often does have fentanyl in it. And so it's you don't have to use scaremongering, you know, you can tell them the truth. And I would also tell them that these more plant-based drugs are less likely to be adulterated. I mean, there's been reports of like fentanyl in marijuana, but there's very little evidence of this happening in any significant way, if at all. I know sometimes, like, when people, the toxicology reports of someone who died, it might have THC in it and also opioids in it, but that could have been used on 2 separate occasions. I think, like, if the buds look and smell normal, you're probably going to be okay. And it would be hard for me to, you know, recommend my kids to say that was okay. But I think ultimately, if you try to tell kids that everything is going to kill them, they're not going to believe you, and you have to maintain some sort of.
So the message is not that everything is going to kill you. It's I think the message that's resonating with kids, and we see that because the majority of kids don't use drugs, is telling them that you want your future, right? You want to grow up and have a great life, and you want to protect your brain. And if you can avoid alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, any drug until at least age 25, when your brain is growing, you'll have less addiction and your brain will grow in the pathway that you want it to.
Well, I completely agree with that. I just don't know. I think it's hard to get kids to think that long term. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I don't know. I think it is working. They're getting that message.
That is sort of a side benefit of the opioid, a silver lining of the opioid crisis is that it really has driven hard drug use down among kids.
Yeah, that's great. So tell me, Ben, what are you working on now? I hear there's a movie in the works.
Yeah, I'm in the finishing stages of a documentary about an opioid treatment drug that's very controversial. It's called naltrexone, best known as the Vivitrol shot. And basically, if you take it, it gives you a 30-day protection from all opioids. So it's like a vaccine. It's like a force field. You could take a full shot of heroin and it just, you wouldn't even feel anything.
Right, because it blocks the opioid receptors.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost the exact same chemical as naloxone, Narcan. The problem is there's been, like, it's barely used at all, and which is crazy. At the height of this opioid crisis, we've got this amazing drug, and it's almost not used. And so my film gets into why, and there's all these sort of big money interests that have been interested in suppressing it. It also works for alcoholism.
Yeah, I prescribe it. I do prescribe it for alcohol, for in the emergency department, And I also, I don't give it to people who have opioid use disorder. I don't know if it's like everything else we've talked to about today, which is follow the money. That's the reason. But it also is technically a lot harder to prescribe than Suboxone?
Well, it needs to be stored in like a freezer case, and it's harder to get your hands on it. But a lot of doctors just are never taught about it in school. It's, you know, Suboxone and methadone are addicting opioids in themselves, and they work great for a lot of people, but a lot of people want to be drug free. And I understand that. And this film gets into why it is that almost nobody is taking this.
Yeah. There's one physician, you know, that I know who runs a clinic and through the emergency department. And it also has to do with the storage. Like if you buy it, right, it's expensive and you need to use all that amount, and then they end up having to waste and throw away a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. There are logistical challenges to it for sure.
Right.
So that was one of the bears. Well, that looks interesting. And what about else? What about new investigations that you're...
Well, you know, stay tuned. I have my my Substack newsletter. It's called Drugs Plus Hip Hop. And I'm always digging up something or other. So
that's awesome. Ben, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. We learned so much from you through your book and this conversation. And good luck with all of the good work. And I hope that your kids stay drug free. I think it's possible.
Yeah, so do I. All right. Well, thanks, Dr. Love.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.